into the darkness. The sodium vapor lights around the parking lot were on. One shone down on her Bonneville, spotlighting it as the only car for 20 yards in any direction. The sense of urgency deflated inside her. Garrett Wright is entitled to counsel, she answered by rote. Mr. Costello is very good at what he does. Do you think it means Wright's guilty? That he feels like he's going to need a better lawyer than he could find in Deer Lake to get him off? I'm not privy to his thoughts. I wish I were. That would make my job easier. She bent and hefted her briefcase, balancing herself on her right toe to compensate for the missing heel. I believe Garrett Wright is guilty. I will do everything in my power to prove that and to convict him. It makes no difference to me who his lawyer is. Costello doesn't intimidate you? Not in the least. Even though he beat you about every 2 out of 3 times when you went up against him as a prosecutor in Hennepin County? Where did you hear that? He shrugged. My source in the system? Cases are individual, Ellen said, hobbling toward her car. I'm confident in our case against Garrett Wright. I will also do everything I can to aid in the capture and prosecution of his accomplice. Got any clues as to who that might be? Adam Slater asked, shuffling beside her. Got any clues about motive? I'm not at liberty to comment. I won't use your name, he promised. I'll call you a highly placed source in the county attorney's office. There are only 5 attorneys on staff, Mr. Slater. That wouldn't exactly ensure my anonymity. He rebounded with the undaunted resilience of youth and bounced on to the next question. There's been no word on motive. What do you think this is all about? Crime is always about something. Sex, power, money, drugs. Or, in the existential cosmic view, is it really just about good and evil? Ellen looked at him, at the avid light in his eyes as he waited for her answer, for a juicy, sensational tidbit his readers back in Grand Forks could scarf up with their breakfast cereal. She had seen degrees of good and evil all around throughout this ordeal. Shades and shadows of darkness, small bright spots of hope for humankind. If Brooks was right about nothing else, he was right about one thing, that the drama being played out around them was, in many ways, a metaphor for the times. But Ellen had no desire to wax philosophical with a reporter who grew up on Brady Bunch reruns and was too young to remember the Beatles. I'm not an existentialist, Mr. Slater, she said. I'm a realist. I realistically believe I can win this case. I won't be spooked by an attorney who spends more on suits than I make in a year, or by the preposterous notion that we're up against a malevolent entity whose evil genius is larger than all of us struggling against it. When you come right down to it, Garrett Wright is just another criminal. I won't give him any more credit than he deserves. It made for a good soundbite, she thought as she drove out of the parking lot. Too bad she didn't quite believe it. Chapter 13. Hannah prowled the quiet house alone, soft music from the stereo her only company. Lily was asleep in her crib. Josh had fallen asleep on the couch watching Back to the Future. Hannah had kept the VCR loaded since the night before. She didn't want Josh watching the news. She told herself she was afraid it might upset him, but the truth was that his reaction to the news bulletin about the Holloman kidnapping had upset her. She had tried to talk about it with him, but after his initial chilling comment, he'd had nothing more to say. Josh, do you know who might have taken that boy away from his family? He shrugged, indifferent, and turned his attention to his box of markers, taking out each one and subjecting it to intense scrutiny. Honey, that little boy's family will be worried sick about him, just like we were worried about you. And he's probably scared too, the way you must have been. If you could help find him, you would, wouldn't you? He pulled a purple marker from the box and held it at arm's length, slowly swooping it through the air as if he were pretending it was an airplane. He had retreated once more into his imagination. Hannah was at a loss as to how to draw him out, or even if she should try. Perhaps it was better to let him come to terms with it on his own, to simply offer him love and support and patience. Then she would think of Dustin Holloman's mother, knowing every fear the woman was experiencing, and she would think she should force the issue, that she should call Mitch and tell him what Josh had said, that she should have told Ellen North, that she should immediately drag Josh back to the child psychiatrist he had seen earlier in the day and relinquish her responsibility. The arguments tumbled around and around in her mind, in her conscience. Ultimately, she felt she would do nothing, and she felt selfish and weak and wrong because of it. But in her heart, she wanted first and foremost to protect Josh, to keep him safe with her, hoping all the ugliness would just go away. She looked down at him, sleeping soundly, and every molecule of her being hurt. She had failed to protect him once. She didn't want to fail him again, but she was flying blind, and she felt so alone. She felt as if she had been taken from the world she knew, where she was certain of her role and her skills, and thrust into an alien world where she didn't understand the language or the customs. Until Josh's abduction, she had never faced real adversity in her personal life. She had never acquired the skills necessary to cope. Even now, as she acquired them unwillingly, she wielded them clumsily, uncertainly. She felt out of balance and knew what was missing was her husband's support. She and Paul had been a team for a long time before that balance had begun to shift. To be without him was to suddenly become an amputee. Beyond the kitchen, the door from the garage to the mudroom opened and closed. Hannah whirled around, automatically putting herself between the unseen intruder and her son. Then the kitchen door swung open and Paul stepped in.
"You could have called first,"
Hannah said angrily as she stepped up into the kitchen.
"It's still my house,"
Paul answered defensively. Hannah drew breath for another attack, then stopped herself short. It had become habit, the thrust and parry of verbal warfare. They didn't even bother with greetings anymore. They had shared a decade of their lives, brought two children into the world, and had reduced themselves to this.
"You frightened me," she admitted.
"I'm sorry." He offered the apology grudgingly. "I guess I should have known better. I didn't think you'd get used to having me gone so quickly."
"It isn't that."
He arched a sardonic brow.
"Oh, so you've decided maybe there's some reason to be afraid of me after all?"
"Oh, Christ."
She pressed the heels of her hands against her closed eyes.
"I'm trying to be civil, Paul. Can't you at least meet me halfway? You're the one who threw me out. You deserved it. There, are you happy now? Have we been ugly enough to each other?"
He looked away, staring at the refrigerator and the notes and photos and drawings that cluttered the front of it, evidence of their life as a family.
"I came to see Josh," he said quietly.
"He's asleep."
"I can't frighten him then, can I?"
Hannah bit her lip on a retort. She wasn't sure what he wanted her to make of it, or what she should make of it. She didn't want to think Josh had any reason to be afraid of his father. Logic told her there was no reason, that Garrett Wright was the man to blame. Garrett Wright was in jail. And another child had been taken. And it was Paul who had caused Josh to react so violently.
"He fell asleep on the couch," she said,
and turned and walked down into the family room. Paul followed her, hands in his pockets, feet seeming to drag across the Berber rug. He looked down at their son over the back of the sofa, some nameless emotion tightening his features.
"How's he doing?"
"I don't know."
"Is he talking?"
She hesitated for a split second, wanting to confide, but realizing she didn't want to confide in Paul.
"No, not really."
"When will he see the psychiatrist again?"
"Tomorrow."
Ellen North and Cameron Reed from the county attorney's office came by today with a photo lineup for him to look at to see if he would pick out Garrett Wright. Anticipation sharpened his expression.
"And?"
"And nothing." He looked at it and walked away. He seems to be blocking the whole thing out. Dr. Freeman says it could be a long time before he faces it. The trauma was too much for him. He was probably told not to talk about it. Threatened. God only knows. God and Garrett Wright. Paul bent down and touched Josh's hair. One stray lock curled around his forefinger
and his eyes filled with tears. Hannah stood where she was, knowing that not long ago she would have gone to him and put her arms around him and shared his pain. That she would no longer do so brought a profound sadness. How could their love have gone so completely? What could they have done to stop it from leaving?
"I wish we could go back," Paul whispered. I wish.
The chant was as familiar as her own heartbeat. Hannah couldn't count the empty wishes, the unanswered prayers. The most important one had come true, to get Josh back, but it had brought on a whole new set of needs and longings and questions she wasn't sure she wanted answers for.
"I wish we could go back,"
to the time in their lives that seemed like a distant fairy tale. Once upon a time, they had been so happy. Now there was only bitterness and pain. Happily ever after was as far beyond their reach as the stars.
"I'll carry him to bed," Paul murmured.
Hannah started to say no, worried that Josh might awaken at the movement and panic at the sight of his father. But she held her breath instead and asked God for this one small favor. Whatever had gone wrong between the two of them, she didn't want to see Paul hurt that way. She didn't want to believe he deserved it. She followed them up the short flight of stairs and stood in the doorway to Josh's room as Paul settled him into the lower bunk and tucked the covers around him. He kissed his fingertips and pressed them softly against Josh's cheek, then went across the hall and looked in on Lily.
"She asks about you,"
Hannah admitted.
"What do you tell her?"
"That you're staying somewhere else for a while."
"But it isn't just for a while, is it, Hannah?"
he said with more accusation than hope.
"You don't need me."
"I don't need this," she said, sharply, as they stepped down into the family room. "The constant sniping, the snide remarks, the feeling that I have to walk on eggshells around your ego. I would give anything for us to be able to set all that aside for Josh's sake, but you can't seem to manage that."
"Me?"
Paul thumped a fist against his chest.
"Yeah, I'm to blame. Bullshit! You're the one who..."
"Stop right there," Hannah demanded. "I will not listen to this again. Do you understand me, Paul? I'm tired of you blaming me. I blame myself enough for both of us. I'm doing the best I can. I can't speak for you. I don't know what you're doing. I don't even know who you are anymore. You're not the man I married. You're no one I want to be with."
"Well, that's fine," he sneered. "I'm out of here."
And so the vicious circle completed itself again, Hannah thought, as the doors slammed. They had danced the dance so many times. Just the thought of it made her dizzy. Exhausted, she sank down onto a wing chair and reached for the portable phone on the end table. She needed an anchor, a friend, someone she could feel safe loving, even if he could never love her back. The phone on the other end rang once, twice. "God Squad, free deliverance." A smile trembled across Hannah's mouth. "We've got a special on penance tonight. 3 rosaries for the price of 2.
"What about shoulders to cry on?" she asked.
The silence was warm and full.
"Buy one, get one free,"
Father Tom said softly.
"Can I put it on my tab?"
"Any time, Hannah," he whispered.
"Any time."
Paul picked his way along the edge of the woods that bordered Quarry Hills Park. The moonlight was intermittent, blinking on and off as dark clouds scraped across its path like chunks of soot in the night sky. He knew the way well enough. The path meant for cross-country skiers had been trampled by countless boots in the last few days as the police had combed the hillside for evidence. Tattered ribbons of yellow plastic crime scene tape clung to tree trunks like synthetic kudzu. He tried to ignore it, and not think about the reason it was there. He needed a break from the nightmare. He needed comfort. He needed love. He deserved something better than Hannah's running him down. She should have been able to see the strain he was under. If she had been a true wife to him, he would have been sleeping in his own bed tonight. Instead, he wanted to seek out another man's wife. That the man was sitting in jail tonight, accused of stealing Josh, brought on a complex matrix of emotions. None of them made him turn back. The kitchen light was on in the Wrights' house. From the woods, his views of the interior were abstract. A rectangle of kitchen, a square of bathroom wall and ceiling, a triangle of bedroom through the inverted V created between the tied-back curtains. Karen was home. He had called her from a payphone and hung up when she'd answered, afraid that her telephone might be bugged. There were no cars in her driveway, no evidence of visitors. Caution and cowardice and guilt held him there at the edge of the woods. Need finally drove him forward. He tracked across the backyard to the door that led into the garage and let himself in, as he had many times before. Garrett Saab had been impounded by the police and taken away, leaving Karen's Honda to take up only a fraction of the floor space. This was where Mitch Holt had arrested Garrett Wright. For a second, Paul could almost hear the sounds of the scuffle, the low pitch of Holt's voice as he recited the Miranda warning. Paul barely knew Garrett Wright. They were neighbors, but not the sort who shared summer evenings and backyard barbecues. Wright held himself apart, superior. He gave his life to his work at the college and regarded the people around him as if they were specimens to be studied and picked apart. It brought a certain bitter pleasure to think of him sitting in jail. How superior was he now?
Paul?
Karen stood behind the storm door looking fragile and startled. Her fine ash-blonde hair framed her face. A pink rose bloomed across the front of her oversized ivory sweater. Feminine. Delicate. Everything he wanted in a woman.
Paul, what are you doing here?
I needed to see you, he said, pulling the door open. Can I come in?
You shouldn't.
But she stepped back into the laundry room anyway. I had to see how you're doing. I haven't seen you since Garrett...
That was a mistake.
She shook her head, not quite looking at him.
Garrett should never have been arrested. He's never been arrested.
He took Josh, Karen.
That's a mistake,
she mumbled, twisting a finger into her hair.
He would never hurt me like that.
He doesn't love you, Karen. Garrett doesn't love you. I love you. Remember that.
I don't like what's happening.
The words came on a trembling whine.
I think you should leave, Paul.
But I need to see you, he said urgently. You can't imagine what I've been going through, wondering about you, wondering if you're all right, wondering if the police have been interrogating you. I've been worried sick. He lifted a hand to touch her cheek.
I've missed you,
he whispered. Soft. She was so soft. Need ached through him. He needed comfort. He deserved comfort. Every night I lay awake, wishing you were with me. I think about us being together, really together. It can happen now. Hannah and I are finished. Garrett will go to jail.
I don't think so,
she murmured. Yes, you don't love him anyway, Karen. He can't give you what you need. You love me. Say you love me, Karen. She hitched a breath. Tears spilling over her lashes.
I love you, Paul.
He lowered his mouth to kiss her, but she turned her face away. She pushed at him, her small hands spread across the front of his coat.
Karen?
He whispered, confused, crushed. I need you! She shook her head, tears tumbling down her cheeks, her lower lip trembling.
I'm so sorry. It was all a mistake.
She slowly sank down along the front of the dryer to sit on the floor. She wrapped her arms around her legs, rested her cheek on her knees, and cried softly.
A terrible mistake.
I made a mistake. The line blinked on and off in Denny Enberg's head, like a neon sign. On and off, the relentless beat like Chinese water torture. You should be happy, Denny, he mumbled, pouring himself another shot of Cuervo. You're out of it. You're off the hook. He had never expected to be put on the hook in the first place. Deer Lake was not a place of intrigue. His clients were generally ordinary, their cases unremarkable. He He lived a quiet, decent life, dull by many standards. There was his law practice, his hunting and fishing, his wife Vicky. She worked nights as an LPN at the rest home and was taking classes at Harris to become an elementary school teacher. They talked about adopting a baby, but had decided to wait until Vicky finished school. The Cuervo went down like liquid smoke. Edges were beginning to blur and soften as he looked around his office. The manly man cave, Vicky called it. The place where he was allowed to hang his hunting trophies and keep his guns and play poker with his buddies once a month. The walls were knotty pine, the floor covered in flat, hard carpet, the color of dirt. His inner sanctum. He allowed no clients back here. His secretary left the vacuum cleaner at the door every Friday. He used it once a month. The building that housed his modest practice sat on the edge of a strip mall parking lot and had once been a laundromat and dry cleaners. Now the other half was occupied by a dentist, who gave him a deal for referring clients who would ruin their teeth in car accidents and barroom brawls. The kind of clients he handled best. Uncomplicated. I made a mistake. Let it go, Denny, he croaked, staring across the room at the 10-point buck that hung above his gun rack. You can't win 'em all. That was what he had told Ellen North when she had stopped by trolling for information. I wasn't aggressive enough. I let my client down. He fired me. It happens. The case could have made him some money, made him a name. But it was gone now, and good riddance. He didn't need the pressure, didn't want the secrets. You seem distracted, Denny, Ellen said. Yeah, well, it was a big case. I could have used the business it would have brought me. But what the hell? Who needs the headache? Your heart didn't seem to be in it. No? Yeah, well, Vicky didn't like the idea of my defending Wright. She thinks he's guilty? Trick question. Withdrawn, she said with a nod. Anyway, the crank calls were getting annoying. What calls? He shrugged. The usual, you scum lawyer variety. Some people believe he's guilty. Now Costello can worry about it. I'm out. She started to leave, turning back toward him at the door, her expression pensive. You know I would never ask you to compromise your ethics, Denny. But I trust you to do what's right. If Garrett Wright is the monster we think he is, he has to be stopped. His accomplice has to be stopped. If you could do something to stop them, I know you would. You would do the right thing. Wouldn't you, Denny? Do the right thing. I made a mistake. He tipped the Cuervo over his glass and drained the bottle. Josh sat up in his bed and looked at the glowing dial of the clock on his nightstand. 12 a.m. His mom had left a nightlight on for him, even though he was much too grown up to have one. He was old now in ways Mom would never understand, in ways he could never explain. He crawled out from under the covers and went to the window that looked out on the lake. In the moonlight, it looked as if it could have been a white desert or the surface of a faraway planet. The ice fishing huts clustered in an area down the shoreline could have been a village of alien life forms. He left his room and went down the hall to check on his mother. The door to her room stood open. She was asleep in bed, though he knew from experience the slightest sound might wake her. He wouldn't make a sound. He could be like a ghost, could move all around, be anywhere, and no one would see him or hear. The quiet was in his mind, and he could make it as big as he was and put it all around him like a giant bubble. He backed away from the door, went down the hall to the bathroom, where a window looked out on the backyard. He climbed up on the clothes hamper and parted the curtains. The snow was silver, the woods beyond like black lace, with the here-and-gone moon shining between the bare branches of the winter-dead trees. There was a mystical, magical quality to the scene that called to him. The feeling frightened him a little, but pulled at him like a pair of big, invisible hands. He wanted to be out there, alone, where no one would watch him, as if they expected him to explode, and no one would ask him questions he wasn't supposed to answer. In the mudroom, he pulled on his new snow boots and put on, over the new purple Viking sweatsuit Natalie Bryant had bought him, the new winter jacket his mom had bought him. People had bought him a lot of presents, like it was Christmas or something. Only when his mom gave them to him, she seemed sad and anxious instead of happy. Josh knew he was the cause of those feelings. He wished he could fix her broken heart. He wished he could make the world right again. But he couldn't. What's done is done. But it isn't over. He didn't like to think about that. But it was in his head, put there by someone he didn't dare go against. The Taker. The Taker said he wasn't supposed to tell, or bad things would happen, and so he didn't talk, even though bad things seemed to be happening anyway. Josh stayed inside his mind, even though it was a lonely place. It was the safest place to be. As quiet as a mouse, he let himself outside. The call came at 2:02 a.m., jolting Ellen from a restless sleep. She sat bolt upright in bed, scattering the files and documents she had fallen asleep reading. The fat three-ring binder that was her Bible for the Wright case tumbled to the floor with a thud. She stared at the phone, her mind rationalizing as it had Monday night. The call was probably work-related. A cop in need of a warrant. There were other cases ongoing in Park County besides the Holloman kidnapping. Or maybe it was about the Holloman case. Maybe it was Karen Wright calling to confess her husband's sins. Still, she couldn't bring herself to pick up the receiver. Harry raised his massive head from the mattress and made a disgruntled sound at having his sleep disturbed. "Ellen North," she answered. Silence hung heavy on the end of the line. "Hello?" When the voice came, it was whisper soft, androgynous, a disembodied spirit that sent chills rushing over her skin like ice water. "The first thing we do, let's kill all the lawyers." The phone went dead. But the words floated and echoed and wrapped bony fingers around her throat. Ellen pulled the covers up high and sat shivering, wondering, waiting, while the night held its breath around her. Journal entry. January 26th, 1994. "They're running in circles, chasing their tails. We play the shell game with lightning-quick minds. Where is Dustin? Where is evil? Who is evil? Who is not?" Chapter 14. Denny Enberg is dead.
What?
Ellen had been literally on her way out the door. Her coat was half-buttoned, her gloves dropped out of her hand. "Looks like suicide," Mitch said. "In his office, sometime last night." The sentences came to her fragmented, as if the phone connection were bad.
"The first thing we do, let's kill all the lawyers."
"Oh my God," she whispered, nausea rolling like a ball in her stomach, stirring her meager breakfast of toast and tea. Even after reporting her crank call and being assured the night commander would send a patrol car past her house, she had slept poorly. Dreams of evil and fear had chased her up from the depths of unconsciousness and trapped her in an exhausting limbo. "Hell of a way to start the day," Mitch growled. "Denny was a decent guy for a lawyer." Ellen tried to gulp a breath, dimly aware that she was hyperventilating. Clammy sweat slicked a film over her skin. "Preserve the scene," she said desperately.
"What?"
"Preserve the scene. I'll be right there. I think he may have been murdered." A steady stream of foot traffic flowed between the donut hut on the corner and Denny Enberg's office on the fringe of the Southtown shopping center. The press, swarming like flies, drifted back and forth, impatient for the news being denied them by closed doors and burly cops. Several recognized Ellen's car and rushed toward her as she turned into the parking lot. She pretended not to see them, letting them fend for life and limb as she roared past them and into the inner circle of green and white police vehicles. She flung her door open as she slammed the transmission into park and hurried toward the building as if she might still be able to prevent what had already happened. The outer office was crowded. Denny's wife Vicky and his secretary huddled together on the small sofa, holding each other and sobbing, their grief intertwining in a wrenching duet. The air was thick with cigarette smoke and the sour tang of sweat from overdressed bodies and overstressed nerves. Ellen grabbed hold of a dark green parka sleeve, not bothering to focus on the face above it. "Where's Mitch?" "In the back. You don't want to go there." "It's my job," she snapped, walking away. But it was something else that sent her down the short hall toward Denny's private office.
"The first thing we do, let's kill all the lawyers."
The smell hit her like a rolling wave a dozen feet from the open door. Violent death. A putrid miasma of blood, bladder, and bowel content. Thick, choking cloying, underscored by the sharp, acidic scent of vomit. Ellen tried to breathe through her mouth. Fighting the urge to gag, she stepped into the office and looked for Mitch. The room was hot and too crowded. Dead animals stared down from the paneled walls with unblinking glass eyes. A deer. A gigantic walleye with nasty teeth, sporting the lure that had been his undoing in some northern lake. An assortment of game birds frozen in mid-flight for all eternity. A radio was playing country music, while portable cop radios crackled with static and mumbled messages. The voices of the men present to investigate and gawk ran together in an indecipherable murmur. Marty Wilhelm's mouth was drawn into a knot, his pallor a sickly pearl gray. A uniformed officer sat on the low black vinyl sofa, with his head down between his knees and a puddle of puke between his boots. Ellen wheeled away from the sight, bile rising in her throat. Mitch caught sight of her.
"Here," he said, thrusting a small jar of mentholatum at her. "Are you sure you want in on this, Ellen? He used a shotgun. It's pretty gruesome."
"I've seen it before," she said gamely, smearing menthol beneath her nostrils.
"Yeah, but it probably wasn't someone you saw at the courthouse every day."
"I'll be fine."
"You'll be on the floor," he muttered. "You're as white as chalk."
"Who found him?"
"His wife. She got home from work about 7:15 this morning. No sign of Denny. No sign that he'd ever come home last night. She tried to call him here and got no answer. It worried her, so she came on down."
"Chief Holt says you have reason to believe Enberg may have been murdered." Wilhelm leaned into the conversation, close enough to let everyone know he was one of the spectators who had lost his breakfast at the site. Ellen swallowed hard and scooped out another finger of mentholatum.
"I got a call last night," she said, focusing on Mitch. "A voice I couldn't recognize." "Male or female?"
"I'm not sure. Male, I think."
"What did he say?"
"He quoted Shakespeare. The first thing we do, let's kill all the lawyers." It echoed inside her head, the disembodied voice, the eerie silkiness of the delivery.
"What time was this?" Mitch asked.
"A little after 2. I called it in, but what could anyone do?" she said. "I thought it might be a threat directed at me. Your watch commander sent a patrol around. I never imagined... it never occurred to me..."
"You couldn't possibly have known, Ellen," Mitch reassured her. "You still can't know."
"It has all the earmarks of a suicide," Wilhelm said. "There are no signs of forced entry, no signs of a struggle. The gun came from his own rack. He rigged the trigger with string."
"I saw him just last night," Ellen said. "He was distracted, a little down, maybe. Not suicidal."
"He had just lost a client in a high-profile case," Wilhelm said.
"But his heart was never in the case," she insisted. "I think he was as relieved as he was disappointed. He told me he'd been getting crank calls."
"Threatening?" Wilhelm asked. "He described them as the you-scum lawyer variety."
"People pissed off because he was defending right," Mitch said. "So why would any of them kill him after he'd been booted off the case?"
Wilhelm shook his head. "They wouldn't. What would be the point?"
"You're right," Ellen said. "But he could have misinterpreted. For all we know, he got the same call I got."
"I can't base an investigation on something that vague, Ms. North."
Mitch ignored the agent's play at power. "So you think what?
that Wright canned him for doing a half-assed job, and the accomplice whacked him to keep him from talking about things that might have been attorney-client related? An attorney can't reveal that kind of information, Wilhelm argued. It's unethical. He'd get his ass disbarred. Mitch shot him an impatient look. You've never heard of anonymous tips? Jesus, Wilhelm, what were you, hatched yesterday? The BCA agent turned pink with temper. Wright fired Enberg Tuesday. Why wait a full 24 hours to off him? It doesn't follow, and the evidence doesn't bear it out. Because it's a game to them, Mitch growled. Wright and his pal like to fuck with people's minds. Wright might have confessed anything to Enberg before he fired him, just for the pleasure of knowing the man would wear a hole in his conscience, trying to decide what to do about it. Like pulling the wings off flies, the sick son of a bitch. The idea shot ice through Ellen's veins, but she did her best to pull together the remnants of the tough shell she had developed working in the city, and shed there 2 years ago. "Let's get this over with," she muttered. Mitch tipped his head in deference. "If you say so." He steered her in the direction of Denny Enberg's desk. "Be calm. Be detached," she recited, calling up old skills that were rusty with disuse. That was the key, not to think of the body as a human being who had a wife sitting out in the reception area. It was just a body. Evidence in a crime. Not a man she had spoken with just last night in this very room. "You know I would never ask you to compromise your ethics, Denny, but I trust you to do what's right. If Garrett Wright is the monster we think he is, he has to be stopped. His accomplice has to be stopped. If you could do something to stop them, I know you would. You would do the right thing. Wouldn't you, Denny?" They would never know. Denny Enberg's conscience was gone, along with most of his head. His body was sprawled in his desk chair, the shotgun used to kill him resting between his spread legs, barrel up. Brain matter, bone fragments, and blood had exploded up and back from the body, sticking to the knotty pine paneling, an acoustic ceiling tile in a grisly spray. Stuart Oglethorpe, Park County coroner and director of the Oglethorpe Funeral Home, stared at what remained of Denny Enberg.
"Well, he killed himself," he announced with disgust.
"Maybe." Oglethorpe glared at Mitch through his thick black horn-rimmed glasses.
"What? It's plain and simple."
"Nothing is simple." Wilhelm blew out a breath. "Look, Chief. He's sitting in his desk chair. There's no sign of a struggle. Do you think he just watched the killer walk in and obligingly opened his mouth for the gun barrel?" Mitch turned away from him, only half listening.
"There's no suicide note," he mumbled.
He pulled a pencil out of the crowded cup beside the blood-stained blotter and tapped it against the empty bottle of Cuervo.
"He'd been drinking," he muttered. "We don't know how much."
"That bottle was half full when I was here," Ellen said.
"What time was that?"
7:30.
"And there's only one glass sitting here," Mitch said. "That's a lot of tequila. The toxicologist can tell us how much. If he drank enough to pass out, that would explain the lack of a struggle."
"What about the string on the trigger?" Wilhelm countered. "The gun was rigged." Mitch scowled at him.
"For Christ's sake, Wilhelm. If you wanted a murder to look like a suicide, wouldn't you be smart enough to trick out the goddamn gun?"
He held up a hand and rolled his eyes.
"Don't answer that."
Turning to Oglethorpe, he said, "As soon as the scene has been processed, we'll get him bagged, and you can transport him up to HCMC. The sooner they get tissue samples to the lab, the better."
"An autopsy?"
The coroner groaned. Once a body was transported to the Hennepin County Medical Center, there was no guarantee of its coming back to the Oglethorpe Funeral Home for preparation for the world beyond, and therefore no guarantee of profit.
"I'll call for the mobile lab."
Wilhelm's tone indicated that he considered it too much trouble.
"Call for a new attitude while you're at it," Mitch ordered. "If you think crimes should be committed in an orderly fashion, one at a fucking time to fit into your schedule, you're in the wrong job, Agent Wilhelm."
The exchange barely registered in Ellen's mind. Her attention was drawn by Denny Enberg's hand, frozen by rigor mortis on the arm of his chair, broad across the palm, with short, blunt-tipped fingers. The plain gold band on his ring finger gleamed. Just an ordinary man, with a decent law practice, and a wife who worked nights. A nice, quiet, ordinary life, that had been taken from him by force. If what she suspected was true, he had been used as a pawn, toyed with, and destroyed, as if he were nothing more than a playing piece in the game.
"I'll talk with his secretary myself," Mitch said, steering her toward the door. "See if he had any late-night appointments scheduled. I wouldn't expect a killer to leave his name, but we might be able to narrow down the time frame. We could even get lucky and find ourselves a witness. He didn't mention anyone to you, did he, Ellen?"
"No. I didn't see anything out of the ordinary, either. My mind was on the case. But humor me, and check to see what Todd Childs and Christopher Priest were doing last night, will you?"
"They're on my list."
"And Paul Kirkwood," Wilhelm said. Mitch's jaw tightened.
"We can't ignore him, Mitch,"
Ellen murmured, with apology in her eyes.
"Yeah, I know," he said with crackling sarcasm. "He is from the BCA.
"She meant Kirkwood," Marty grumbled. Ellen checked her watch as she stepped into the hall.
"I've got to get out of here. I've got a meeting at 10, and if I don't shower and change out of these clothes, Judge Grabko is liable to hold me in contempt."
She looked up at Mitch with gratitude.
"Thanks for listening to me, Chief. I'm afraid if it had been left up to Agent Wilhelm and our esteemed coroner, Denny would be on an embalming table this afternoon. I think Wilhelm got a little more than he bargained for with this field post. He comes here in the middle of a kidnapping. Before his first week is up, there's another, and now a potential homicide. Before this thing is over, he's going to wish he could give the job back to Megan."
"How's she doing?"
He glanced away, his jaw tightening. "As well as can be expected. Unfortunately, no one is expecting much. Except Megan herself. She's too damn stubborn for her own good."
"She's a fighter."
"Yeah. I'm just worried about what happens if she can't win this fight."
The cruelty of Wright's game just kept spreading outward like an ink stain, blacking out Megan's career, Josh's innocence, Dustin Holloman's future, Denny Enberg's life. It had touched Ellen's own life as simply and easily as a phone call.
"The first thing we do, let's kill all the lawyers."
"We'll get a trace on your home phone," Mitch said, backing down the hall as someone called to him from Denny's office. "I'll talk to you later."
Ellen nodded and waved him off. For a moment, she was all alone, halfway between the death scene and the mourners. She would have to stop on her way out and offer her condolences to Denny's wife, then fight her way through the media mob to get to her car. All she wanted was a nice, quiet, well-ordered life. Like Dennis Enberg. Like the Kirkwoods and the Hollimans. Suddenly she needed to breathe air that didn't stink of death, to let the cold air clear her head. She turned right, went down the short hall, and let herself out on the back side of the building. A stiff wind slapped her face. She opened her mouth and gulped it in. Leaning back against the building, she let herself mourn for the loss of a life and the loss of something less tangible. Peace and safety. The sense of immunity people here had wrapped around themselves like a warm woolen blanket. She had left Minneapolis, but she hadn't run from it, no matter what Tony Costello believed. She had chosen to go, had chosen this town and the life she led here. If she had to fight for it, she would fight with everything she had. Ellen took a final deep breath and walked back inside to face a colleague's widow and the voyeurs who would report this latest tragedy to the world. Chapter 15. Gorman Grabko had an extensive collection of bow ties. As a second-year law student, he had been impressed with the idea that every memorable man created his own image. That year, he had begun wearing bow ties. He had been wearing them for 33 years. Always discreet and tasteful, never the clip-on variety. Today, he had chosen a dignified gray-on-gray stripe, that complemented the steel color and the close-cropped salt-and-pepper beard he wore to hide the ancient craters of rampant teenage acne. The hair on the sides of his square head was darker, with flags of silver at the temples. There was no hair on top of his head. Baldness had been a distinguishing trait of the Grabko men for centuries. He wore it as proudly as his judge's robes and the dark Brooks Brothers suit beneath them. Grabko was well aware there were judges in the rural districts who paid little attention to style. He had accepted it as his mission to uphold standards. He had degrees from Northwestern, had taught at Drake Law, was a patron of the arts, and aspired to someday sit on the state Supreme Court. He hoped that day would not be too far in the future, though it was difficult for a judge to distinguish himself in a place like Park County. For the most part, crimes here were petty, trials simple, the attorneys uninspired. The chance to hear a case the likes of the state versus Dr. Garrett Wright was a rare occasion. Gorman Grabko had prepared himself accordingly. He sat behind his immaculate desk with the air of a benevolent monarch, smiling warmly at Anthony Costello. "Mr. Costello, it's a pleasure and an honor," he said. "It isn't every day we get an attorney of your reputation in the Park County Courthouse. Is it, Ellen?" Ellen made a small motion with her lips. No one could have called it a smile. She wanted to tell Grabko he should be thankful. But then, that wasn't the comment he wanted to hear. The question was rhetorical, at any rate. The judge continued without waiting for her opinion, essentially shutting her out of their little male bonding ritual. Or maybe it was less a guy thing than it was a celebrity thing. She could have got a better handle on it if Cameron had been there, but he had a competency hearing in Judge Witt's courtroom that morning, and so she was on her own. "You're a Purdue man, I'm told," Grabko said. Costello grinned. "I hope, as a Northwestern alumnus, you won't hold that against me." Grabko beamed, obviously flattered that Costello knew anything about him. "Both fine Big Ten schools. You've certainly done yours proud. You've made quite a name for yourself. I keep abreast of the goings-on in the Metropolitan Courts," Grabko said importantly, as if he had been appointed to do so by some higher power and wasn't motivated by simple envy. "I keep busy." Ellen struggled not to gag on Costello's false modesty. "Dr. Wright was lucky you could squeeze him in between murder trials." "Yes, things do get hectic in the cities." Costello cut her a look. "But then, you knew all about that once upon a time, didn't you, Ellen? It's understandable it could become overwhelming for some people." He made it sound as if she had cracked under the pressure and been shuttled out to the country to live in shame and secret. Grabko put his head a little on one side and looked at her with a glimmer of suspicion. Ellen narrowed her eyes on Costello. "Sickening is a better word, though some people don't seem to mind wading through sewage. But we shouldn't take up Judge Grabko's time reminiscing," she said with a saccharine smile. "He has a very full schedule." "I'm concerned about the timetable with your just arriving on the case, Mr. Costello," Grabko said. "Can I assume you'll want the omnibus hearing postponed?" "No, Your Honor. The defense will be fully ready to proceed. Eager to proceed, in fact. Every day these charges hang over Dr. Wright's head is another day his character is unnecessarily blackened." Costello hit Grabko full beam with his game face. Tough, direct, intense. "Your Honor, my first duty to my client is to rectify the injustice done him earlier in the week, when the late Judge Franken set bail well beyond his reach." "The man was apprehended running from the scene of a crime," Ellen jumped in. "Allegedly. He brutally beat an agent of the BCA. Allegedly. And did his best to escape. He's an obvious flight risk." Costello stood abruptly, taking Grabko's gaze with him. He walked toward the windows where milky light drained in through fat Venetian blinds. "Dr. Wright is entitled to the presumption of innocence," he said. "He is, in fact, an innocent man. Under the statutes of this state, he is entitled to a reasonable bail. $500,000 in cash is hardly reasonable." Grabko stroked his beard. "Neither is kidnapping an 8-year-old child or torturing a woman." Costello wheeled around. "Oh, come on, Ellen. You can't possibly believe Garrett Wright did any of that. He's a respected professor." "I know exactly what Garrett Wright is, Mr. Costello." Ellen came to her feet, advancing toward him with her hands planted on the hips of her narrow, tobacco-brown skirt. "He is a man who stands accused of multiple felonies and did his best to elude capture. I don't argue that the assailant fled the scene. I argue that my client was not the assailant. Funny, then, how he was the one taken into custody. He was obviously the man captured, but he was not the perpetrator of the crimes. The evidence suggests otherwise." "We'll see about that, Counselor," Costello said calmly, "if it goes that far." Ellen crossed her arms and stood there, as Tony slid back into his chair and crossed his legs, carefully straightening the jacket of his pinstriped suit to avoid wrinkles. He looked too cool, like a card sharp with an ace up his sleeve. She weighed the idea of calling his bluff. Her silence lasted long enough to force his hand. He looked at Grabko. "Your Honor, I'm going to state right up front, we plan to file a motion to dismiss on the grounds of unlawful arrest. The Fourth Amendment prohibits police, absent exigent circumstances or consent, from making a warrantless entry into a suspect's home in order to make a felony arrest. Peyton versus New York." "Oh, please." Ellen sneered, positioning herself at the side of Grabko's desk. "The man was fleeing arrest, armed and dangerous. You don't consider these exigent circumstances? The situation meets all criteria." She ticked them off, one by one on her fingers. "A grave offense was involved. The suspect was believed to be armed. There was obvious likelihood of escape. Not only was there reason to believe he was on the premises, Mitch Holt virtually followed him through the door." "Virtually, but not actually." Costello directed his attention to the judge, choosing not to waste his energy or his argument on Ellen. It was Grabko he needed to sway. "The truth of the situation is that the suspect Chief Holt was pursuing was wearing a ski mask. He never saw the man's face, had no reason to assume the man he was chasing was Dr. Wright. By his own admission, Chief Holt lost sight of his suspect numerous times during the chase, including just before he burst into Dr. Wright's garage. It is our contention that Chief Holt, in fact, lost sight of his suspect for too long a period of time to continue pursuit into Dr. Wright's garage without benefit of a warrant." Ellen made no effort to contain the sarcastic laugh. "That is the most preposterous load of..." "Ellen, that's enough," Judge Grabko said firmly. She pressed her lips together and took her seat. "The decision will be mine to make," Grabko said. "File your paperwork, Mr. Costello. Your argument has merit. It's worth consideration." "But, Your Honor, you'll get your chance, Ms. North," Grabko said, jotting a note to himself. "It sounds to me as if the arrest skirts some boundaries. Convince me otherwise. At any rate, it's an issue for the omnibus hearing, and I believe we're here to discuss the matter of bail." With 1 point scored, Costello drew in a refreshing breath and leaned forward, his you're-my-pal look firmly in place. "Your Honor, considering Dr. Wright's ties to the community, his lack of a record, and what can only be called flimsy evidence against him, we request bail be reduced." Grabko turned to Ellen, eyebrows raised. "I believe Judge Franken was more than fair and reasonable, considering the weight of the charges." The judge sat back and swiveled in his chair, tugging at a white spot in his beard. "Wouldn't you say, Ellen," he began in his law professor voice, "that the bail in the amount of $500,000 cash is, for all intents and purposes, denial of bail?" Ellen said nothing. Of course it was denial of bail. She thought of Josh Kirkwood, who had barely spoken a word since his return. She thought of Megan, battered, broken, haunted, her career likely ended by Garrett Wright's vicious brutality. She thought of Dennis, the smell of his death sneaking down the back of her throat. She thought of Wright himself, imagined she could feel his gaze probing into her as she had that day in the interview room. "It seems extreme to me," the judge went on. "I'm familiar with Dr. Wright's reputation and with his juvenile offenders program, and from what I know of the man, I have difficulty seeing him as a flight risk at this point." "But, Your Honor, that's just the point, don't you see?" she pleaded. "The college professor isn't the man we're dealing with here. We're dealing with a side of Garrett Wright that might be capable of anything. The man is evil.
Costello rolled his eyes.
Isn't that a little melodramatic, Ellen?
You wouldn't think so if you'd been in your predecessor's office this morning.
He had the gall to let amusement tint his surprise.
You're blaming my client for Enberg's death? That would be quite a trick, considering he was in jail at the time.
Grabko frowned at her and brushed a thumb along his jaw.
$100,000, cash or bond.
Mr. Brooks, what angle are you planning to take on this story?
Jay frowned at the reporters that had clustered around him. They had gathered in the courtroom to catch the latest twist of the case. Anthony Costello was going to ask for bail to be reduced. But the stars of the show had yet to come on stage, and the press had grown as restless as toddlers in church. One group was circled around Paul Kirkwood, who had positioned himself in the first row behind the prosecution bench. With a writer's ability to eavesdrop and carry on a conversation at the same time, Jay picked up the gist of Paul's statement. Justice, victims' rights, the American way.
I don't know that there'll be a book, Jay said, shaking his head. I'm just here as an observer. Y'all are the ones working this case.
He might as well have told them he had come to declare himself dictator and absolute ruler of the state of Minnesota. They heard what they wanted to hear and ignored the rest.
Will you be working with the family, or are you interested in Dr. Wright's story?
No comment, fellas.
He flashed them a grin.
Now listen, y'all got me talking like a lawyer. That's more work than I want to do.
Their eyes lit up like Christmas bulbs, and he knew he had made a grave mistake. A blonde with a microphone leaned toward him.
As a former defense attorney, Mr. Brooks, what is your opinion of the firing of Dennis Enberg, who allegedly committed suicide early this morning, and the arrival of his replacement, Anthony Costello?
A man had blown his head clean off, and Blondie slid it into the scheme of things as if it were just another point of minor interest in her story. The idea disgusted him. The disgust amused him in a twisted sort of way. Ellen would have said he was no better than this woman, with her hunger for a story. He had come here for what was, on the surface, the same reason. In truth, he had deeper reasons, but they may, in fact, have been worse. Self-loathing twisted his mouth into a bitter smile.
"Ma'am, I haven't been an attorney in a very long time," he said. "And hell, if I'd been any good at it, I'd probably still be doing it, wouldn't I? I can't see where my opinion on any of this is worth a hill of beans."
"And yet you don't hesitate to take sides in your books."
She refused to be brushed off with "aw shucks" and a famous grin.
"Your critics, prominent defense attorneys among them, say you have a sharp eye for the law and that your analysis of trials is akin to laser surgery."
At the front of the courtroom, the door to the judge's chamber swung open, and instantly the attention of everyone in the room swung forward. Ellen emerged first, looking furious. Jay could tell she was fighting to keep her expression blank, but her whole body looked as tight as a clenched fist, and her eyes glittered with the same kind of fire she had directed at him a time or two. Costello strolled out behind her, relaxed, confident. He looked directly at the members of the press. The conquering hero, the champion for the common man, provided the common man could come up with the bucks. The judge, the Honorable Gorman Grabko, climbed to his perch and seated himself. Prim was the first adjective that came to mind. He looked like the kind of man who would use shoe trees and wax his bald spot. Hallway scuttlebutt indicated he was a stickler for form and that he tended to lean toward the defense, holding the prosecution to a higher standard. By the look of things, Ellen had fallen short. A side door opened, and Garrett Wright was led in by a pair of deputies and seated at the defense table. It was over in a matter of minutes. The skirmish had been fought in chambers, as most of them were. This show was for the record, and for the spectators who had gathered to watch the drama unfold. Costello formally stated his request. Ellen argued against it. Grabko's mind was made up.
"Bail is set in the amount of $100,000, cash or bond," the judge announced.
"This is an outrage," Paul Kirkwood shouted, leaping up from his seat. His face flushed the color of dried blood, and a vein stood out prominently in the side of his neck.
That animal stole my son, and you're letting him out!
A beefy deputy rushed up the aisle and grabbed hold of him. Paul put a shoulder into him and staggered him back a step toward the defense side of the room.
You ruined our lives!
He screamed, thrusting an angry fist in Wright's direction. Grabko smashed his gavel down. He had risen to his feet and called for more deputies. The courtroom rang with shouts and shrieks and the scuffling sounds of physical struggle. More deputies rushed in. Three of them grabbed hold of Paul Kirkwood and herded him toward the nearest exit. He twisted around as they dragged him.
I want justice! I want justice!
The reporters rushed after him in a flock. The remaining deputies hustled Wright and Costello out a side door. Grabko shook his head, banged his gavel, and declared court adjourned for the morning. The room was empty in a matter of seconds, everyone running into the hall to catch the continuation of Paul's show. Everyone except Ellen. She sat at the table with one arm banded across her middle and the other hand raised as a prop for her chin. She stared up at the empty bench, as if she were trying to will the blindfold off the figure of Lady Justice. Jay hung back, his eyes on Ellen. He should have been out in the hall. Paul Kirkwood's penchant for theatrics intrigued him. There was something slightly off about those performances, something that struck Jay as calculated, disingenuous. But he couldn't seem to make himself turn away and walk out. Instead, he opened the gate and let himself onto the business side of the bar. Because he wanted to hear Ellen's take on things, he told himself. That was all. Not because she looked small and forlorn, sitting there all alone. Not because it touched him in any way that she was taking the loss hard.
It's only bail, he said.
Tell that to Paul Kirkwood, Ellen murmured. Drive out to Lakeside and break that news to Josh's mother. Or maybe you want to call Megan O'Malley in the hospital and tell her?
It's only bail.
She faked a nonchalant shrug as she turned in her chair to face him. Why shouldn't Garrett Wright be free to walk the streets, free to communicate with his accomplice, who may have committed murder last night, who is, as we speak, doing God knows what to Dustin Holloman? He moved closer, his hands stuffed into the pockets of his rumpled slate-colored dockers. He had shed his coat somewhere. A bright silk tie hung like a strip of modern art down the front of his worn denim shirt. The knot was jerked loose, and the top button undone, as if he just couldn't bear the symbolism of a noose around his neck, and yet felt compelled to make a token show of formality.
You lost the round, not the game, he said,
settling a hip on the corner of the heavy oak table. His thigh brushed against the back of her hand. The contact had the quality of an electric shock. Ellen tried to cover the involuntary reaction by shifting positions, reaching up to brush at a stray hair that had come loose from her twist. It's not a game.
Of course it is. You've played it 1,000 times. You know the rules. You know the strategies. You gave up some points. It's not the end of the world.
Ellen glared at him, anger burning through the haze of defeat.
A man gave up his life last night. How many points is that worth?
She asked bitterly, pushing to her feet.
What's that worth to you? Another chapter? A page? A paragraph?
I didn't kill him, and I can't bring him back. I can only try to put it in context. Isn't that what you want to do? Make sense of it? Understand it?
Oh, I understand it. Now let me put it in a context you can understand. It's a game, all right, Mr. Brooks. Dennis Enberg was a piece they didn't need anymore, and now he's dead. And his replacement just drew the get-out-of-jail card for his twisted bastard of a client, and I couldn't manage to stop any of that from happening.
The rage and the pain boiled up inside her, boiled over the rim of her control. She turned her back to him and pressed her hands over her face, furious with herself. She had thought she had control of her emotions, if nothing else, in all this madness. She had vowed to fight this battle, but somehow she hadn't seen the possibility for this early defeat. She thought of Costello's threat to get the arrest thrown out, and felt sick at the possibility. If she could lose this battle, she could lose that one. That vulnerability was terrifying and raw. Jay watched her struggle to rein in her feelings. Her back was ramrod straight, her shoulders straining against the need to shake. Despite all the time she had spent working in the system, she had managed to hang on to a sense of right and a sense of honor. She fought hard and took her losses harder. Cynicism hadn't dulled the lance of justice for her as it had for so many, as it had for him. It seemed only to have made her more keenly aware of her place in the scheme of things.
"You didn't think it could happen here, did you?"
he murmured, stepping behind her.
"It shouldn't be happening here," she whispered. "Children should be safe."